You'll find all over the landscape, people presume that those that hold conspiracy theories are some kind of wacko nuts. Now, it intrigues me that, in fact, part of the mission statement of one of these ministries claims to be an expertise in watching conspiracy theories, and yet it's obvious as we look at their publications, they are simply uninformed. This came up in a discussion with Chuck. They started to talk about conspiracy theories, and Chuck stopped them at the comma. He says, wait a minute, didn't you hear the State of the Union address the other day? And if you were paying attention, you saw global, 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 global. And I want to hit this one head on, because there's a concept being promoted in the mainline media that anyone that adheres to some kind of conspiracy pushing us towards a world government are somehow worthy of ridicule. And the standard attack on these views maintains that the New World Order is the result of a turn-of-the-century right-wing, bigoted, anti-Semitic group of racists acting in the tradition of the long-ago debunked protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and so forth. Now, admittedly, on the landscape, there are some weird groups promoting some weird ideas, but these are peripheral, have little to do with this tide towards the New World Order. The historical record, if you do your homework, does not support these positions that are promoted by the mainline media or by people who would seem to be within, theoretically, or within the body of Christ. The New World Order term has been used thousands of times since the turn of the century, not by the right, but by the left that's promoting it in high places of our federal government. Those involved in promoting the so-called New World Order, some of them, a few of them have been Jewish. The preponderance have not, and so this is not some kind of Jewish plot as some of these anti-Semites would like to promote. Let's take a look at the reality. For years, leaders in education, in the industry, in media, banking, have promoted a worldview that is equivalent to theirs. You say that, gee, just because some individuals promote a common viewpoint, that doesn't constitute a conspiracy. Well, that's true, except some of it has been somewhat underground, but it's now become a very open conspiracy. And it was described by Fabian socialist H.G. Wells in a book called The Open Conspiracy, Blueprints for a World Revolution, published in 1928. But you can go back to 1913 as another example. This is prior to the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, which, of course, is neither federal nor a reserve anyway. President Wilson's The New Freedom was published in 1913, in which he said as follows, quote, since I entered politics, I have chiefly had men's views confided to me privately. This is the President of the United States saying this. Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacturing are afraid of somebody, and they're afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere, so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it, close quote. That's by President Wilson, not some newsletter writer. On November 21st, 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt wrote a letter to Colonel Edward Mandell House, President Woodrow Wilson's close advisor. The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element of larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson. And on he goes. See, that there is such a thing as a cabal of power brokers who control the government behind the scenes. That has been detailed many times in this century by credible sources. Professor Carol Quigley, who was incidentally Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University. President Clinton, incidentally, publicly has paid homage to him at least twice, publicly. Now, in Quigley's magnum opus, it's called Tragedy and Hope, and it's available again from publishers, published originally in 1966. He said as follows. This is the expert on the on this whole subject from the inside. Quote, there does exist and has existed for a generation an international network which operates to some extent in the way that the radical right believes that the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the roundtable groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists, nor any other groups that frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 60s to examine its papers and its secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and many of its instruments. I have objected, both in the past and recently, to a few of its policies. But in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. And, of course, now it is known. Even Rush Limbaugh, an outspoken critic of anyone claiming to push for global government, said on his February 7th, 1995 program, quote, "You see, if you amount to anything in Washington these days, it is because you've been plucked or handpicked from an Ivy League school, Harvard, Yale, Kennedy School of Government. You have shown an aptitude to be good Ivy League type, and so you're plucked, so to speak, and you are assigned success. You are assigned a certain role in the government somewhere, and then your success is monitored and tracked, and you go where the pluckers and handpickers can put you." And he goes on about that, which is interesting, because, you know, anyway. On May 4th of 1993, the Council for Foreign Relations, the president of the Council for Foreign Relations, Leslie Gelb, said on the Charlie Rose Show, "You, that is Charlie, had me before to talk about the New World Order. I talk about it all the time. It's one world now. The Council, meaning the CFR, can find, nurture, and begin to put people in the kinds of jobs this country needs. That's going to be one of the major enterprises of the Council under me." The present CFR chairman, John J. McCloy, this is from about 53 to 70, actually said they have been doing this since the 1940s and before. The thrust towards global government is well documented. But at the end of the 20th century, it does not look like a traditional conspiracy in the usual sense of a secret cabal of evil men meeting clandestinely behind closed doors. Rather, it is a networking of like-minded individuals in high places to achieve a common goal, as described in Marilyn Ferguson's 1980 Insider classic, The Aquarian Conspiracy. Now, perhaps the best way just to get a flavor of this whole thing is to take a look at a brief history of the New World Order. Not in our words, but in the words of those who have been striving to make it real. In 1912, Colonel Edward Mandel House, a close advisor to Wilson, publishes Philip Drew Administrator, in which he promotes socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx. The next year, 1913, the Federal Reserve, which I think most of you realize is neither federal nor a reserve, is created. It was planned at a secret meeting in 1910 on Jekyll Island in Georgia by a group of bankers and politicians, including Colonel House. And this transferred the power to create money from the Treasury of the United States government to a group of private bankers. It is probably the largest generator of debt in the world. On May 30th, 1919... prominent British and American personalities established the Royal Institute of International Affairs in England and the Institute of International Affairs at the U.S. At a meeting arranged by Colonel House, attended by various Fabian socialists, including noted economist John Maynard Keynes, 2 years later, Colonel House organizes the Institute for International Affairs into the Council for Foreign Relations, the CFR. And on December 15th of 1922, the CFR endorses world government in its magazine of foreign affairs. Philip Kerr there wrote, "Obviously, there's going to be no peace or prosperity for mankind as long as the earth remains divided into 50 or 60 independent states until some kind of international system is created. The real problem today is that of world government." In 1928, a book called The Open Conspiracy, Blueprints for a World Revolution by H.G. Wells published. And that's where he said, "The political world of the open conspiracy must weaken, efface, incorporate, and supersede existing governments. The open conspiracy is the natural inheritor of socialist and communist enthusiasms. It may be in control of Moscow before it is in control of New York, but the character of the open conspiracy will now be plainly displayed. It will be a world religion." Interesting. 1931, students of the Lenin School of Political Warfare in Moscow are taught as following, quote, "One day we shall start to spread the most theatrical peace movement the world has ever seen. The capitalist countries, stupid and decadent, will fall into the trap offered by the possibility of making new friends. Our day will come in 30 years or so. The bourgeoisie must be lulled into a false sense of security." And on it goes. Then in 1932, all kinds of new books are being published urging world order. Toward a Soviet America by William Z. Foster, head of the Communist Party, USA. He indicates that the National Department of Education would be one of the means used to develop a new socialist society in the United States. Another book, New World Order by F.S. Marvin, describing the League of Nations as the first attempt at a new world order. He says, "Nationality must rank below the claims of mankind as a whole." And then a book called Dare the School Build a New Social Order, published by educator, author George Counts. It asserts, quote, "The teachers should deliberately reach for power and then make the most of their conquest in order to influence the social attitudes, ideals, and behavior of the coming generation. The growth of science and technology has carried us into a new age where ignorance must be replaced by knowledge, competition by cooperation, trust in providence by careful planning, and private capitalism by some form of social economy, and so forth. And then, of course, in 1933, the first Humanist Manifesto was published. Co-author John Dewey. John Dewey's an interesting guy. When David Breese published a book, The Seven Men Who Rule the World from Their Graves, John Dewey, of course, is listed among them. And much of our predicament today can be laid at his feet, as I think history will show, ultimately. C.F. Foster, one of the co-signers of this manifesto, said in 1930, "Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every American public school a school of humanism. What can theistic Sunday schools, meeting for an hour once a week, teaching only a fraction of the children, do to stem the tide of a five-day program of humanistic teaching?" Interesting insight. 1933, The Shape of Things to Come, H.G. Wells publishes again, predicts a Second World War around 1940, originating from the German-Polish dispute. That's kind of interesting in 1933. After 1945, there would be an increasing lack of public safety in criminally infected areas. The plan for a modern world state would succeed on his third attempt, about 1980, can come out of something that occurred in Basra, Iraq. Kind of interesting perspective for a guy back in the early 30s. Now, the book also says, although the world government has been plainly coming for years, although it has been endlessly feared and murmured against, it found no opposition prepared anywhere. That's his predictive. Now, something else that most people are not aware of is the occultic link to all of this. In 1934, one Alice A. Bailey of the Theosophical Society published The Externalization of the Hierarchy. She's an occultist whose works, she says, are channeled from a spirit guide, the Tibetan master, or demon spirit, Joal Kuhl. Bailey used the phrase, points of light, in connection with a new group of world servers, and claims that 1934 marks the beginning of organizing of men and women, a group work of a new order with progress defined by service, the world of the brotherhood, the forces of light, on it goes, out of the spoliation of all existing culture and civilization, the new world order must be built. This book was published by the Lucifer Trust. That was changed its name now to the Lucis Trust because it's a little more palatable. And the Lucis Trust is a United Nations non-governmental organization, has been a major player at recent UN summits. Later, the Assistant General, Secretary General of the UN, Robert Mueller, would credit the creation of his World Core educational curriculum to the underlying teachings of Joal Kuhl via Alice Bailey's writing on the subject. Did you realize that our educational philosophies, which derive from Robert Mueller's work at the UN, were channeled by a demon spirit? That's kind of interesting. 1932, Plan for Peace by American Birth Control League founder Margaret Sanger was published. She calls for coercive sterilization, mandatory segregation, rehabilitative concentration camps for dysgenic stocks, including blacks, Hispanics, American Indians, and Catholics. We may laugh, I understand, and at the same time realize what's being perpetrated. Interesting. October 28, 1939, in an address by John Foster Dulles, who later became the United States Secretary of State, he proposed that America lead the transition to a new order of less independent, semi-sovereign states bound together by a league or federal union. And, of course, in 1939, H.G. Wells is at it again with a New World Order book. He proposes a collectivist one-world state or New World Order comprised of socialist democracies. He advocates universal conscription for service, declares that nationalist individualism is the world's disease. He quote, the manifest necessity for some collective world control to eliminate warfare and less generally admitted necessity for a collective control of the economic and biological life of mankind are aspects of one and the same process. And he proposed that all this be accomplished through universal law and propaganda or education. In 1940, the New World Order is published by the Carnegie Endowment for the International Peace and contains a selected list of references on regional and world federation and so forth. Now, on December 12th of 1940, in the Congressional Record of the United States, an article entitled The New World Order by John G. Alexander calls for a world federation. In 1942, the Leftist Institute of Pacific Relations published The Post-War Worlds. It goes on and says, the world government is the ultimate aim. It must be recognized that the law of nations takes precedence over national law. The process will have to be assisted by the deletion of nationalistic material employed in the educational textbooks and its replacement by material explaining the benefits of wiser association. As I read that, I'm reminded a few months ago when my wife had, and I had an extra day in Washington. We went to the National Museum of American History because we were just in the mood to see, get, you know, that, all that stuff. And we couldn't find any American history. Lots of exhibits about how we abused the Indians. And there's exhibits of the China of the first ladies through several of the old administrations. No founding fathers, no heritage, no expression of what this country really was founded on. In June 28th of 1945, President Truman endorses world government in a speech. He says it will be, quote, it will be just as easy for nations to get along in a republic of the world as it is for us to get along in the Republic of the United States, close quote. And of course, on October 24th of 1945, the United Nations Charter becomes effective. And it was also on October 24th, Senator Glenn Taylor, Democrat from Idaho, introduces Senate Resolution 183 calling upon the United States Senate to go on record as favoring the creation of a world republic, including an international police force. And of course, we have in 1946, Alger Hiss is elected president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He holds this office until 1949 because early in 1950 he is convicted of perjury, sentenced to prison after a sensational trial and a congressional hearing in which Whitaker Chambers, a former senior editor of Time magazine, testifies that Hiss was a member of his Communist Party cell. Interesting. 1946, book by the teacher of the world government by a former editor of the NEA Journal, the National Education Association Journal, Joy Elmer Morgan, is published. It says, quote, in the struggle to establish an adequate world government, the teacher can do much to prepare the hearts and minds of children for global understanding and cooperation. At the very heart of all the agencies which will assure the coming of world government must stand the school, the teacher, and the organized profession. 1947, the American Education Fellowship, organized by John Dewey, calls for the establishment of a genuine world order, an order in which national sovereignty is subordinate to world authority. And it goes on like this. I'm not going to get all of these. They'll be in a two-part series in our newsletter, so you can check these out. 1948, Walden II is published by behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner, in which he proposes, quote, a perfect society of new and more perfect order in which children are reared by the state rather than by their parents and trained from birth to demonstrate only desirable behavior and characteristics. Skinner's ideas would be widely implemented by educators by the 1960s, 70s, and 80s as values clarification and outcome-based education. And in July of 1948, Britain's Sir Harold Butler, in the CFR's quarterly called Foreign Affairs, sees, quote, a new world order, close quote, taking shape. Quote, how far can the life of nations, which for centuries have thought of themselves as distinct and unique, be merged with the life of other nations? How far are they prepared to sacrifice part of their sovereignty without which there can be no effective economic or political union? Out of the prevailing confusion, a new world is taking shape, which may point the way toward a new order. That would be the beginning of real United Nations, no longer crippled by a split personality, but held together by a common fate. 1948, UNESCO president, then Fabian socialist, Sir Julian Huxley, calls for a radical eugenic policy in UNESCO, its purpose and philosophy. He states, quote, thus, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy of controlled human breeding will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care, and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake, that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. You see, they chip away inch by inch, they're patient. Also in 1948, the preliminary draft of a world constitution is published by the United States educators advocating a regional federation on the way toward world federation in our government, with England incorporated into a European federation. The constitution provides for a world council with a chamber of guardians to enforce the world law. Also included is a preamble calling for the nations to surrender their arms to the world government, and includes the right of this, quote, federal republic of the world, close quote, to seize private property for federal use. On February 9th, 1950, the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee introduces the Senate Concurrent Resolution 66, interesting number, which begins, whereas in order to achieve universal peace and justice, the present Charter of the United Nations should be changed to provide a true world government constitution. This resolution was first introduced in the Senate in September 13th, 49, by Senator Glenn Taylor, and Democrat in Idaho. Senator Alexander Wiley, Republican in Wisconsin, said that it's a consummation devoutly to be wished. For he said, I understand that your proposition would either change the United Nations or change or create by a separate convention a world order. Senator Taylor later stated, quote, we would have to sacrifice considerable sovereignty to the World Organization to enable them to levy taxes in their own right to support themselves. On April 12th of 1952, John Foster Dulles, again, he said in a speech to the American Bar Association in Louisville, Kentucky, quote, treaty laws can override the Constitution. He pointed that out. He says treaties can take power away from Congress, give them to the president. They can take powers away from the states, give them to the federal government or to some international body. They can cut across the rights given to the people by their constitutional Bill of Rights. A Senate amendment proposed by Republican Senator John Bricker would have provided that no treaty could supersede the Constitution. But it failed to pass by one vote. Interesting. Now, as you read this history, you stop and think. I don't know if you visited Yosemite National Park or Yellowstone National Park, but you may be aware from newspaper articles that they are now policed by the United Nations. They're not a national park because we apparently weren't diligent in doing it the way the UN thought it ought to be done, so they've taken them over on the basis of the Heritage Act of 1974. That's kind of interesting. So this isn't academic. This isn't just a history course of people's thinking. It's manifestation of a tide of a conspiracy. When I was in Liechtenstein with our ambassador, Admiral Bill Middendorf, and Howard Phillips, Conservative Caucus, I remember asking Howard, because he's probably one of the best informed guys in Washington, and a Christian, really growing too, by the way, neat guy. And because of some other flack I was getting recently, I had to refresh my memory on what happened in Liechtenstein, because I had to admit I had forgotten some details, so I called Howard, and he filled me in on those details. But I remember that conversation back then, I asked Howard, I said, you know, I really try to get a perspective of the so-called conspiracy thing. And he says, Chuck, there isn't one conspiracy, there are many. There's just as many struggles for power within the extreme left as there are anywhere else. The collective effect, of course, is a tide and a trend, and indeed there is a master conspirator that gave his name to one of the trusts involved. Okay? All right. Now, 1954, Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, he establishes a group that's come to call the Bilderbergers, because that's where they met the first time, international politicians, bankers, and they meet secretly on an annual basis. And the secrecy of those meetings has finally been punctured, and we now know a great deal about them. But anyway, 1958, the World Peace Through World Law was published, where authors Grenville Clark and Lewison advocate using the UN as a governing body for the world and world disarmament and world police force and so on. 59, the Council of Foreign Relations calls for a new international order. Study number 7, issued on November 25, advocated, quote, a new international order which must be responsive to world aspirations for peace, social and economic change, international order, including states labeling themselves as socialist. Read that, communist. The only difference, a communist is simply a socialist with a gun that's in a hurry. 1959, or somebody once quipped, I think, that a socialist is a communist who knows what he's doing. 1959, the World Constitution Parliament Association is founded. It later develops the diagram for world government under the Constitution for the Federation of Earth. 1959, also the mid-century challenge to the United States foreign policy. It's published by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. It explains that the U.S., quote, cannot escape and indeed should welcome the task which history has imposed upon us. This is the task of helping to shape a new world order in all its dimensions, spiritual, economic, political, and social. Did you get that? Spiritual, economic, political, and social. September 9th, 1960, President Eisenhower signs the Senate Joint Resolution 170, promoting the concept of a federal Atlantic Union. An address is later given called The Goal of the Government of All the World, in which stated, for it becomes clear that the first step of the world government cannot be completed until we have advanced on four fronts, the economic, the military, the political, and social. In 1961, the United States State Department issues a plan to disarm all nations and arm the United Nations. State Department document number 7277 is entitled Freedom from War, the U.S. Program for the General and Complete Disarmament of a Peaceful World. It details a three-stage plan to disarm all nations and arm the United Nations, with a final stage in which no state would have the military power to challenge progressively strengthened United Nations. Interesting. 62, new calls for world federalism. And I don't want to badger all of these stuff. I'm just trying to give you a flavor. This is a tide. It's got a long, deep history. But the labeling, the goals, the insights don't come from the right or the extremists or the militias. They come from the people doing it, for anyone that's done their homework. 1963, J. William Fulbright, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, speaks at a symposium sponsored by the Fund for the Republic, a left-wing project of the Ford Foundation. He says, quote, "The case for government by elites is irrefutable. Government by the people is possible, but highly improbable," close quote. In 1964, the Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, Handbook 2, author Benjamin Bloom states, "A large part of what we call good teaching is the teacher's ability to attain effective objectives through challenging the student's fixed beliefs." You see, his outcome-based education method of teaching would be first tried as mastery learning in the Chicago schools. And after 5 years, the Chicago students' test scores had plummeted, causing an outrage among the parents. But the OBE would leave a trail of wreckage wherever it would be tried and under whatever name it was used. And at the same time, it would become the crucial to the globalists for overwhelming and overhauling the educational system to promote attitude changes by the school students. In 1964, Visions of Order by Richard Weaver is published. He describes progressive educators as a revolutionary cabal engaged in systematic attempt to undermine society's traditions and beliefs. In 1967, Richard Nixon calls for a new world order in his publication Asia After Vietnam. In the October issue of Foreign Affairs, Nixon writes of the nation's dispositions to evolve regional approaches to development needs and to the evolution of a new world order. And on this goes. In July of 26, 1968, Nelson Rockefeller pledges support of the new world order. In Associated Press report, he pledges that as president, he would work toward an international creation of a new world order. In 1972, Nixon visits China and is toast to Chinese Premier Chou Enlai, former CFR member and now president. Richard Nixon expresses the hope that each of us has to build a new world order. In the speaking of the coming of world government, Roy Ash, director of the Office of Management and Budget, you may remember him as a partner of Tex Thornton in the Lytton thing, but anyway, he declares that within 2 decades, the institutional framework for a world economic community will be in place, and aspects of individual sovereignty will be given over to a supranational authority. Of course, in 73, that's when the Trilateral Commission was established. Banker David Rockefeller organized this private body and chose Brzezinski, later to become the National Security Advisor to President Carter, as the Commission's first director, and invites Jimmy Carter to become a founding member. And I do have a report that Jimmy Carter, when he was running, was given a list of Christians and conservatives for the cabinet. We're hoping that someone would have been appointed. And this friend of mine, I'll leave it nameless for the moment, in talking to Jimmy. Jimmy was in tears. He was not allowed to make one appointment. They were all dictated to him. 1973, Humanist Manifesto II is published. "The next century may be and should be a humanistic century. We stand at the dawn of a new age, a secular society on a planetary scale. As non-theists, we begin with humans, not God, nature, not deity. We deplore the division of humankind on nationalistic grounds. Thus, we look to the development of a system of world law and world order based upon transnational federal government. The true revolution is occurring." But study after study, anyway, from all these people and all these organizations continue. 1975, retired Navy Admiral Chester Ward, reformer judge advocate general of the United States Navy, and former CFR member. Writes in a critique that the goal of the CFR is the submergence of U.S. sovereignty and national independence into an all-powerful world government. In 1975, Kissinger on the Couch is published. Authors Phyllis Schlafly and former CFR member Chester Ward state, "Once the ruling members of the CFR have decided that the U.S. government should espouse a particular policy, the very substantial research facilities of the CFR are put to work to develop arguments, intellectual and emotional, to support the new policy and to confound, discredit, intellectually and politically, any opposition." In 1976, we had the Reshaping the World Order publication by the Globalist Club of Rome, calling for a new international order, including economic redistribution of wealth. And 1977, the Third Triad World Order is published by Harlan Cleveland of the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. It calls for changing Americans' attitudes toward institutions, a complete disarmament except for international soldiers, and for individual entitlement to food, health, and education. So you get the idea, America is the main barrier to this all happening, of course, and so that's the focus here. Let me pick 79, interesting quote from Barry Goldwater, who is retiring as a Republican senator from Arizona. He publishes his autobiography called With No Apologies. He said, quote, "In my view, the Trilateral Commission represents a skillful, coordinated effort to seize control and consolidate the four centers of power, political, monetary, intellectual, and ecclesiastical. All this is to be done in the interest of creating a more peaceful, more productive world community. What the trilateralists truly intend is the creation of a worldwide economic power superior to the political governments of the nation states involved. They believe that the abundant materialism they propose to create will overwhelm the existing differences. As managers and creators of the system, they will rule the future. In 1985, Norman Cousins, the honorary chairman of the Planetary Citizens of the World We Choose, is quoted in the magazine Human Events as follows, quote, "World government is coming. In fact, it is inevitable. No arguments for or against it can change that fact," close quote. Cousins is also president of the World Federalist Association, affiliate of the World Association for World Federation, headquartered in Amsterdam. And the WAWF is the leading force for world federal government and is accredited by the UN as a, quote, NGO, a non-governmental organization, as is the Alice Bailey's group and so on. 1987, the Secret Constitution, the Need for Constitutional Change, is sponsored in part by the Rockefeller Foundation. Boy, in 1988, former Undersecretary of State CFR member George Ball, in the January 24th interview of the New York Times, says, quote, "The Cold War should no longer be the kind of obsessive concern that it is. Neither side is going to attack the other deliberately. If we could internationalize by using the UN in conjunction with the Soviet Union, because we now no longer have to fear, in most cases, a Soviet veto, then we could begin to transform the shape of the world, might get the UN back to doing something useful. Sooner or later, we're going to have to face restructuring our institutions so that they are not confined merely to the nation state. Start first on regional, and ultimately, you could move to a world basis." And on December 7th of 1988, in an address to the United Nations, Mikhail Gorbachev calls for mutual consensus. Quote, "World progress is only possible through a search for universal human consensus as we move toward a new world order." Carl Bernstein, of the Woodward and Bernstein fame, if you will, wrote a book called Loyalties, A Son's Memoir, is published. His father and mother had been members of the Communist Party. Bernstein's father tells his son in the book about the book, quote, "You're going to prove that Senator Joseph McCarthy was right, because all he was saying is that the system was loaded with communists. And he was right. I'm worried about the kind of book you're going to write and about cleaning up McCarthy. The problem is that everybody said he was a liar. You're saying he was right. I agree that the party was a force in the country," and so on. Oh, I love this one from the World Federalist Association, 1990. It faults the American press. Writing in the summer-fall newsletter, Deputy Director Eric Cox describes world events over the past couple of years and declares, quote, "It's sad but true that the slow-witted American press has not grasped the significance of most of these developments. But most Federalists know what is happening. They are not frightened by the old bugaboo of sovereignty." And, of course, Bush calls the Gulf War a major opportunity for the New World Order and said so before the Congress. In October 1st, 1990, in a UN address, President Bush speaks of the collective strength of the world community expressed by the UN as an historic achievement towards a New World Order, a new partnership of nations, a time when humankind has come into its own to bring about a revolution of the spirit and the mind and to begin a journey into a new age. Now, the famous talk in 1991, President Bush praises the New World Order in his State of the Union message in 1991. He said, quote, "What is at stake is more than a small country. It is a big idea, a new world order to achieve universal aspirations of mankind based on the shared principles and rule of law. The illumination of 1,000 points of light, the winds of change are with us now, etc." And, of course, many people picked up that buzzword from the occultic writings of Bailey and so on. You say, gee, Chuck, why are we getting into all of this tonight? I'm sure I've wearied you with more quotes than you really want. The point is, first of all, I want you to be sensitive to the disinformation that is being promoted by people who have an agenda. And that agenda is disinformation. That agenda is to confuse you. That agenda is to somehow lump people who are concerned about this tide of events. And by using smear tactics and trying to color this as if it's some kind of anti-Semitic issue. There are weird groups that like to call it the Jew World Order. They point out that some of the bankers in the past happened to be Jewish, and so they try to paint a picture that somehow these ideas are manifestations of some kind of Jewish conspiracy. This is the kind of nonsense you hear promoted by the anti-Semitic extremists. They will harp about a document called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, a manifestly anti-Semitic fraud, a hoax that was perpetrated many years ago, is discredited by anyone that has done their homework. But the point is, the fact that there are some of these weird groups There's an attempt by the government and others to link those with the militias. There are a few that have a militia-like quality, but the point is, the tragedy is there are many militias that are wholesome, straightforward people that are simply seriously concerned about the erosion of our Bill of Rights and so forth. But the real point is, one of the strategies is to put all these in the same bucket. And there's an attempt by the administration, and there's an attempt by a number of people from the left to somehow paint biblical Christians into the same mold. The whole point is we need to have our head up. When I say, Chuck, what does this politics, these are philosophies? No, it's more than that. It's an attack on freedom of speech. It's an attack on freedom of religion. But more also, it is consistent with a prophetic scenario. I find it quite interesting that people who do not take the conspiracy theory kinds of things seriously are also people that are not sophisticated in their eschatology. It's interesting that people who have done their homework in terms of biblical eschatology, if they understand what Jesus said about the end times, then some of the things we watch on the horizon of our world today are fascinating. And I want to remind you that Jesus chided the Pharisees in Matthew 16. In Matthew 16, he quotes to the Pharisees an ancient seaman's proverb. We've all probably heard it in modern terms, but basically what Jesus says to them, you say, red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Now that's an old proverb, and it happens to be a reasonably accurate way of predicting the weather. And the point is that Jesus says you can discern the weather, but you can't discern the signs of the times. Now, he held them accountable to understand his presence. In fact, when he rides the donkey into Jerusalem, knowing that he's going to be, 4 days later, he's going to be crucified, he says, because you did not recognize this thy day, these things are going to be held from you. Not forever. Paul will tell us how long that's going to endure. But the blindness in Israel is declared by Jesus in Luke 19. In the 40 through 44 in there, Jesus demonstrates that he held them accountable to understand that very day. It was a day that Zechariah had predicted he would ride a donkey proclaiming himself as king. The angel Gabriel had told Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 the exact day that was to happen. And on that day he does. And on that day he held them accountable to understand God's program. But instead they rejected him. And because they rejected him, they're blinded. Not forever. Paul tells us. He hammers away for three chapters in the book of Romans, climaxing the fact that Israel has a destiny that's irrevocable. And their blindness will be relieved once the fullness of the Gentiles become in. But the point is as you study prophecy, as you understand what the Bible really lays out, and then you look around, and I don't mean just as Israel and Jerusalem and the temple, the Middle East in general, as you look at what's going on with Magog, Russia, and the rest, as you look at what's going on in Europe, as you see them nudging their way also to a confederation, and then you watch the United States, it's amazing how many people come to you and say, gee, I don't understand, where's the United States in prophecy? Man, look around. Read Clinton's State of the Union speech. The point is that I think that the great tragedy is that the confusion and the criticisms are not coming from those who are manifestly our enemies, from the pagans and the ungodly from outside our ranks. So when we look at, I know this has been kind of a tough strain for you. Many people are a little concerned because sometimes our newsletter tends to focus somewhat on these cover-ups going around. Why? Because, for a number of reasons. First of all, Jesus told us, when four disciples came to Jesus and asked him about his second coming. And he gave them a two-chapter answer that's recorded in three of the Gospels. But the first thing he did as he got into his whole discourse on the second coming, he says, beware lest they deceive you. Deceit was the byword of what was coming. And we live clearly in an age of deceit. And we have talked a lot about how in this country that we've taken so much for granted, we see cover-ups at Ruby Creek, where the FBI has to admit they falsified the evidence before the federal court proceedings. And of course, Waco is a well-publicized thing, and so the BATF screwed up. Fine, but why is the FBI bulldozing the place before any investigators could go in there? What's going on here? And Oklahoma City. I've been criticized by some because we've hinted that, somehow that there's a government involvement in the Oklahoma City. Listen, the last few weeks they're impaneling in Oklahoma City another grand jury because the locals are so convinced that the government is covering up the real facts. There are the people who have lost their children in the daycare center have rallied around Tim McVeigh, not because they think he's innocent, but they think he's being railroaded to hide what really happened. I don't know what really happened, but I noticed the locals who are really involved smell trouble there. The judge who was going to try the thing admitted he was warned not to go to his office that day. The TV manager says he watched helicopters remove employees off the roof before the bomb went off. What's going on? And on it goes. So the point now, we find, interestingly enough, and although we've been criticized by a number of elements of the body of Christ for getting into all this, wait a minute, that we're somehow harboring that the government, there's a government conspiracy. The FBI is now enduring the biggest scandal of the entire history of the Bureau because of the tainting of procedures on the Oklahoma City thing, and there's about 1,000 criminal cases of recent years that are being reopened because these guys that are now serving time may be released because of the tainting of the handling by the FBI vaunted crime lab.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your cassette over at this time for the continuation of this message.